velvety and pampered assemblage, but he seems to have liked Banks well enough and could not but admire his talents in botany, a feeling shared by posterity. Never before or since has a botanical party enjoyed greater triumphs. Partly it was because the voyage took in so many new or little-known places. Tierra del Fuego, Tahiti, New Zealand, Australia, New Guinea. But mostly it was because Banks was such an astute and inventive collector. Even when unable to go ashore at Rio de Janeiro because of a quarantine, he sifted through a bale of fodder sent for the ship's livestock and made new discoveries. Nothing, it seems, escaped his notice. Altogether, he brought back 30,000 plant specimens, including 1,400 not seen before, enough to increase by about a quarter the number of known plants in the world. But Banks's grand cache was only part of the total haul in what was an almost absurdly acquisitive age. Plant collecting in the 18th century became a kind of international mania. Glory and wealth alike awaited those who could find new species, and botanists and adventurers went to the most incredible lengths to satisfy the world's craving for horticultural novelty. Thomas Nuttall, the man who named the wisteria after Caspar Wistar, came to America as an uneducated printer, but discovered a passion for plants and walked halfway across the country and back again, collecting hundreds of growing things never seen before. John Fraser, for whom is named the Fraser Fir, spent years in the wilderness collecting on behalf of Catherine the Great, and emerged at length to find that Russia had a new Tsar who thought he was mad and refused to honor his contract. Fraser took everything to Chelsea, where he opened a nursery and made a handsome living selling rhododendrons, azaleas, magnolias, Virginia creepers, asters, and other colonial exotica to a delighted English gentry. Huge sums could be made with the right finds. John Lyon, an amateur botanist, spent two hard and dangerous years collecting specimens, but cleared almost $200,000 in today's money for his efforts. Many, however, just did it for the love of botany. Nuttall gave most of what he found to the Liverpool Botanic Gardens. Eventually, he became director of Harvard's Botanic Garden and author of the encyclopedic Genera of North American Plants, which he not only wrote, but also largely typeset. And that was just plants. There was also all the fauna of the New Worlds, kangaroos, kiwis, raccoons, bobcats, mosquitoes, and other curious forms beyond imagining. The volume of life on Earth was seemingly infinite, as Jonathan Swift noted in some famous lines, "So naturalists observe, a flea hath smaller fleas that on him prey, and these have smaller still to bite 'em, and so proceed ad infinitum." All this new information needed to be filed, ordered, and compared with what was known. The world was desperate for a workable system of classification. Fortunately, there was a man in Sweden who stood ready to provide it. His name was Carl Linné, later changed, with permission, to the more aristocratic von Linné, but he is remembered now by the Latinized form Carolus Linnaeus. He was born in 1707 in the village of Roschult in southern Sweden, the son of a poor but ambitious Lutheran curate, and was such a sluggish student that his exasperated father apprenticed him, or, by some accounts, nearly apprenticed him to a cobbler. Appalled at the prospect of spending a lifetime banging tacks into leather, young Linné begged for another chance, which was granted, and he never thereafter wavered from academic distinction. He studied medicine in Sweden and Holland, though his passion became the natural world. In the early 1730s, still in his 20s, he began to produce catalogues of the world's plant and animal species, using a system of his own devising. And gradually, his fame grew. Rarely has a man been more comfortable with his own greatness. He spent much of his leisure time penning long and flattering portraits of himself, declaring that there had never been a greater botanist or zoologist, and that his system of classification was the greatest achievement in the realm of science. Modestly, he suggested that his gravestone should bear the inscription Princeps Botanicorum, Prince of Botanists. It was never wise to question his generous self-assessments. Those who did so were apt to find they had weeds named after them. Linnaeus's other striking quality was an abiding, at times one might say a feverish, preoccupation with sex. He was particularly struck by the similarity between certain bivalves and the female pudenda. To the parts of one species of clam, he gave the names vulva, labia, pubis, anus, and hymen. He grouped plants by the nature of their reproductive organs and endowed them with an arrestingly anthropomorphic amorousness. His descriptions of flowers and their behavior are full of references to promiscuous intercourse, barren concubines, and the bridal bed. In Spring, he wrote in one oft-quoted passage, "Love comes even to the plants. Males and females hold their nuptials, showing by their sexual organs which are males, which females. The flower's leaves serve as a bridal bed, which the Creator has so gloriously arranged, adorned with such noble bed curtains and perfumed with so many soft scents, that the bridegroom with his bride might there celebrate their nuptials with so much the greater solemnity. When the bed has thus been made ready, then is the time for the bridegroom to embrace his beloved bride and surrender himself to her." He named one genus of plants Clitoria. Not surprisingly, many people thought him strange. But his system of classification was irresistible. Before Linnaeus, plants were given names that were expansively descriptive. The common ground cherry was called Physalis amnoramosissime ramis angulosus glabris foliis dentoceratis. Linnaeus lopped it back to Physalis angulata, which name it still uses. The plant world was equally disordered by inconsistencies of naming. A botanist could not be sure if Rosa silvestris alba cum rubore folio glabro was the same plant that others called Rosa silvestris inodoro seo canina. Linnaeus solved the puzzlement by calling it simply Rosa canina. To make these excisions useful and agreeable to all required much more than simply being decisive. It required an instinct, a genius, in fact, for spotting the salient qualities of a species. The Linnaean system is so well established that we can hardly imagine an alternative. But before Linnaeus, systems of classification were often highly whimsical. Animals might be categorized by whether they were wild or domesticated,